out of Oklahoma City, you're listening to the Good Trash Genre Cast, where movies are more than just 90 minutes in a bucket of popcorn. The Good Trash Genre Cast is a member of the Good Trash Media family. For more information, go to goodtrashmedia.com. They're talking about you, boy,
but you're still the same. Hello, everybody, and welcome again to the Good Trash Genre Cast, where a bunch of people gather around a table and we discuss the films that'll never come up in a film studies course, but we apply analysis to them anyway. I'm very, very glad to be here talking with you all about the film Looper, a documentary about a young Boy Scout trying to earn his knot-tying merit badge.
That doesn't sound very interesting, Dustin. Why do we pick this?
I would watch the shit out of that movie.
He's a looper. And
yeah, no, yeah, I got it. I got the joke, Dad.
Sorry. We're going to be talking about Looper, Bruce Willis, and, you know, JGL, and they're the same person. And it's going to be interesting and exciting, but I must first allow the disembodied voices to identify themselves around the table to my left. Sir, who are you?
I am Arthur Gordon, and what did my grandfather know? Hang on, let me ask him. Dustin?
You're real funny. Thank you for that. On around to the left, who's next?
My name is Dalton Stewart, and be careful, Dustin. You'll shoot your other foot off.
Oh. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Dalton Stewart. On around, who are you?
Hi, my name's Caleb Masters, and this podcasting crap, it just fries your brain like an egg.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm going to try to explain to you guys what I'm doing as I'm Dustin Sells, but we'd be drawing diagrams with straws, and who has time for that?
You know, there's another waitress that works weekend shifts here.
Oh, yeah.
Jen.
Yeah, less letters.
Less letters.
That would hurt.
That's one of my favorite jokes.
Would not have been a bad idea. All right, so now you know who we all are. I want to go back to Caleb Masters for just a moment for a special announcement.
Yeah, Dustin, do you like to watch movies? Do you like to hear filmmakers talk about movies that they've made? We are going to be doing a live show. Good Trash Media presents The Fable of Shannon Cable live. We're going to be sitting down talking to our friends over at Planet Thunder about their first film, The Fable of Shannon Cable. We're going to be doing some of our analysis, and we're also just going to be hanging out. You're going to be doing that here in Oklahoma City at the Parish, which is down in the Plaza District. Again, local here in Oklahoma City. If you need more instructions on the directions or the address, check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/goodtrashmedia and check out the event page there. I'm really, really excited to just get to hang out with a bunch of our listeners and actually be able to interact and see your lovely faces.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Caleb Masters. So, without any further ado, Mr. Arthur Gordon, voice the cinema. Let's hear that synopsis, please.
In 2074, when the mob wants to get rid of someone, the target is sent into the past where a hired gun awaits. Someone like Joe, who one day learns the mob wants to close the loop by sending Joe's future self for assassination.
Okay, yeah. That doesn't explain a lot, but yeah, that is much of what we're doing here with this particular film. Let's go ahead and hear those thumbs up, thumbs down reviews. I go to you first, Mr. Caleb Masters. What have you got to say?
Yeah, well, when Looper hit theaters a few years back, I remember being more excited about this film than I ever had, like a low-key sci-fi film. I was like, this movie, it's time travel. I'm a massive sucker for time travel films. It's my favorite, like, sci-fi plot device. It had Joseph Gordon-Levitt, it had Bruce Willis, and it was directed by Rian Johnson, who was, like, one of my favorite, like, kind of indie directors. I've loved everything he's done. So when I watched it, of course, not only did I think it was a good movie, because it was, but I was also into that fan. I was like, man, this is the best freaking sci-fi since sliced bread, okay? So I watched it now that it's been...
Sliced bread, the famous Russian science fiction film.
Yes.
Exactly. But you guys got me on that one. Now that I've...
Don't you mean sliced red?
Oh!
Boom! There we go. I was thinking the sliced bread line, actually, but sliced red is even better.
So, now that I've had some time to distance myself from the film, and after rewatching it for the first time in probably about 2 or 3 years, I really still like this film a whole lot. I think the script is really smart. The world building is brilliant in its shorthand storytelling. And the acting is lots of fun. I can't say it's amazing acting, but it's fun. Like, all the actors look like they're... I mean, JGL's having a blast doing a Bruce Willis impression, and Bruce Willis, I think, he's just glad he's getting something a little meatier than his normal fare.
He's more turned on in this film than I think he's been within the last 5 years.
Yeah.
I mean, he's really focused. I mean, he does some things in this film that are some of the best acting I think he's done in the last 20 years.
Oh, yeah. I'd agree with that sentiment, actually. Now, in hindsight, when I noticed it's a little rough around the edges than I kind of remembered. I think some of the dialogue sometimes comes off as a little bit strange, like, we call it letting your loop run. I was like, well, what else are you going to call it? You know, just little... That's sudden and picky, but just little stuff like that. It seemed the whole film, the film as a whole, was a little rough around the edges than I remembered. I still think it's a really great script, and I think the story is really, really great, but just really weird things like that that just I noticed kind of was like, eh, that's not as great as I remember it. And I also think that the pacing shift about halfway through the movie is pretty jarring. I'm not saying that the second half of the film is weaker. I think the second half of the film is really what this movie's about. But it going from that whole world-building setup and all the action, fast-paced, everything, all of a sudden to slam on the brakes, we're on this farm and we're doing a character study, which is all of it's very interesting, but there's this, it doesn't quite flow as smoothly as I kind of had remembered. And like all time travel movies, the time travel logic breaks down. More on that in my analysis. Either way, I think this is one of the better executions of time travel we've seen in the last 15 years, and I think it's just a really great low-key sci-fi film that everyone should probably check out.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Caleb Masters. Mr. Dalton Stewart, what do you say in terms of thumbs up, thumbs down review?
Well, I definitely want to echo some of Caleb's sentiments, particularly my feelings towards this film, because similarly, I was extremely excited about this movie when it came out. I loved Brick. So yeah, much like Caleb, I was super stoked, and this is the first time I have watched Looper since its initial release, and I've got to say, yeah, I've mellowed on it a little bit. I definitely like it a lot still. I would agree with Caleb that some of the jargon does feel a little forced and silly. It seems like Johnson was trying to recapture a little bit of that patter that he brought to Brick, and it feels more forced here. It doesn't feel quite as natural. But I definitely still like it. We've talked about the world building this film does on the show before, actually, and that is one of my favorite things about it, is that really easy, quiet way it builds the world. Things like solar panels on cars that looks like it's very been clearly like aftermarket jerry-rigged onto it. I think that's really cool, stuff like that. The floating jet bikes or whatever, I think that all that stuff's really neat. The money, having Chairman Mao on it, I thought was a really interesting touch. Things like, you don't want to go to France. I'm from the future. Go to China. Like, Jeff Daniels in this movie kills me. I think he's great. Mm-hmm. Noah Segan, who plays Kid Blue, I could have used a lot more of him. He's kind of Rian Johnson's guy. He always plays a smaller character in his films, but I always really like him a lot, and I could have used more of him because I found his character really interesting. And I will agree with Caleb that tonal and pacing shift halfway through the movie is really jarring. I think the second half of this film is the better half, but the switch to it comes very abruptly and takes a little bit to adjust to. The last thing I want to touch on, you know, Caleb has talked about the performances already. I do want to say I like JGL's Bruce Willis impression, for lack of a better word, a lot. I'm not so sure about the makeup. When it works great. When it works, it is perfect. When it's not working, it's really not working. Because we know what Bruce Willis looked like when he was in his early 30s. We remember. You can go watch Die Hard. So you know exactly what Bruce Willis looked like at that point in his life. So to try and make JGL up, it works. Like, again, when the lighting's right, it looks perfect. But when the lighting's a little too harsh, it just looks a little silly sometimes, and it does, I think, detract from things. I think it detracts from how good his performance is, because he is capturing a lot of Willis's mannerisms and his verbal tics. That's one thing he gets really well, is his pattern of speaking, which I think is really impressive. But yeah, that makeup is real distracting sometimes, as much as I like the idea to kind of subtly make them look a little more similar. And finally, Bruce Willis, holy shit. He is so good in this movie. And his story, the fact that his character arc involves the things that involves, again, we want to stay out of spoilers in this section, but he does some pretty heinous things. And you still have something resembling sympathy for his character. And I think that shows a lot in terms of what he brought in his performance and what Rian Johnson's screenplay brought to the film. So overall, a really solid science fiction film that has just enough going on under the surface to make it stand the test of time, I think.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Dalton Stewart. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what say you in terms of thumbs up, thumbs down review?
You know, I'm really on the fence about this movie. I think it looks great. I think Johnson's direction is one of the best things about it. I think it's slick, it's stylish, it's well shot, and features some phenomenal score. On the flip side, though, I really like the first part of this film a lot more than the rest.
Really?
Yeah. I
mean, it's cool. It is cool as hell.
I think the most interesting things about this movie fall apart once Willis shows up. When he drops down in that field, I feel like it hits a wall, and that's that tonal shift I think that Caleb and Dalton are speaking to. I mean, yeah, it's cool to watch Bruce Willis plow through people with assault weapons. I can't connect with that part of the movie. I love the first act. I love the interactions between Levitt and Paul Dano, and that's the movie I want to see a lot more of.
Yeah, the stuff with Paul Dano's loop is really, really haunting.
Yeah.
Like, disturbing in a really cool way.
And so Blake Snyder has this rule in Save the Cat about double mumbo jumbo, where you can sell the audience on one weird thing, but don't try for two. And that's what I really feel like with the telekinesis thing. Mm-hmm. I'm already going into this accepting time travel, but now there are mutants involved. And I don't know that I like the way that's integrated into the plot. It feels off at times for me.
Yeah, I think they introduce it really well with Paul Dano floating the quarter in the car. So I agree that to some extent, though, that it does kind of overcomplicate the plot a little bit. Yeah. I think that it's introduced very well. They just don't. It becomes such a central plot thread that they don't make it more important slowly.
Yeah. You know, and it's fine in an X-Men movie because that's what I've been conditioned to expect out of an X-Men movie. But not here, Rian Johnson. Not here.
Fair enough. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Arthur Gordon. When I first saw this film, I saw it as a double bill. I had watched Seven Psychopaths and then this in a theater, and it was excellent. And I have to say, compared to Seven Psychopaths, which was my favorite film of that year.
I remember.
Looper was less.
You and I kind of got into it on this show way, way back.
A little bit.
That you and me differed on it very strongly.
And I like it better now when I watch it sort of in isolation. I don't know that I like it a ton or love it or anything like that, but no, it's got all the good feels. It's got the great look. It's got the good performances. The makeup is a little weird at times, and I don't really appreciate that, as you've said already, Dalton. Also, I think that Johnson is doing something really cool with playing with science fiction tropes of time travel, but he's also got to be aware of other paradoxes that viewers are going to be thinking about. Because one thing I kept thinking and wondering and was waiting for was some sort of confirmation that perhaps the child Sid was also, you know, the three of them. That there was a child, there was a middle-aged or, you know, early 30s young man, and then there was Bruce Willis. They were all the same person, which they weren't, and they're not. But I'm expecting that because that is sort of very tropey science fiction. And then he makes the mistake of when JGL has a moment of realization. I'm not going to spoil here, but he uses these sort of sepia-toned looks as he's thinking about the life Sid's going to have. And as he's doing that, that sepia tone is standard film grammar for a flashback. And if you're not paying close attention, if you're at all distracted or, you know, in any way checked out, it is a little confusing because he is using a bit of grammar, you know, in cinema that is not really typically used for that. There were other ways he could have handled that. It's not a flaw, really, but it is, I think it's something of a mistake.
I don't agree with you on that at all, by the way. Just for the record, because I never once made that connection or was expecting that connection, and the three times I saw that, I was like, oh, I didn't like how – I was never confused by the sepia tone.
Yeah, well
– Not once.
Again, it is a standard grammar, though. I think we can all concede that point.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that.
Yeah, and so, again, if you're not attentive, and if you are, again, looking for the that's what I was waiting for, was the twisty sort of additional bit to the loop. The last moment where you realize, oh, you know what? And I'm thinking about 12 Monkeys a little bit. The boy is Bruce, right? And watching himself die. Mm-hmm. And
I think that's you bringing your own baggage into the film, though. Well, I don't think that's the film's fault that you're reading, that you're wanting to read that into the film.
No, I think that's fair, because what Dustin brings up is that Johnson is playing so much with the tropes of science fiction films and specifically time travel films. Again, yes, there is a little bit of Dustin's baggage coming in, but I think it's a fair baggage to bring in based on the way that Johnson plays with time travel tropes throughout, the way he engages with them and converses with them. It's not out of the realm of expectation for a viewer that other tropes that are kind of clinking around in the back of your brain might show up on screen.
Yeah, well, but do you criticize any movie? It doesn't have to be this movie, for not doing a thing you're expecting it to do?
I think what Dustin's, again, this is not my argument, I'm just trying to help Dustin flesh out a little bit. I think what Dustin's getting at, though, is when you start the conversation of tropes in a film, when your film is actively engaging with those things, you just have to be careful with it. You have to be cautious with it.
Explicit. And I mean, he could, I mean, interestingly, he could have set it up as a red herring that it turned, and we would discover absolutely 100% without a doubt Sid is not him. But it's really sort of just it lays there in expectation land and then is never really dealt with.
Well, the thing that I think is more interesting is that he does see a lot of himself in Sid, and I think that's more interesting. The son who had a mother that went away, the only difference is Sid's mom came back, and Joe's mom did not, and I think that's more interesting. But I definitely get where you're coming from, Dustin.
All right, and again, it's just a mistake in film grammar. If you're going to play the game, you just need to be aware of those possibilities. And I would have taken much to deal with that, and I think perhaps would have made that ending a little bit stronger. It's still pretty good. I still like it quite a bit. But that's what I would say in terms of my thumbs up, thumbs down review. So there you go, dear listener. You know our biases. We're middling to pro, and we generally kind of like it, and it's fun, and it's definitely something that we think is entertainment. But enough of this. Let's take a moment and play the game.
It's time to play the game. Time to play the game.
This week's game are actors you'd like to see play their older and younger selves.
That's right. Actors you'd like to see play their older and younger selves. Brought to you by Lupa. Lupa. A funny nose and eyebrows gets you a pretty convincing Bruce Willis.
Fair enough. So there you go, dear listener. Now, we're going to make those selections a la JGL and Bruce Willis. I go to you first, Mr. Dalton Stewart. What are your selections?
Well, the first one I actually came to mind has already been done, unfortunately, but I'm going to go ahead and mention it anyway, and hopefully it'll happen in a better movie, and that is Michael Fassbender and Ian McClellan. Obviously, they both played versions of Magneto. Magneto's not a character.
Magneto is
McDonald's
it's
time.
Dalton, it's a Magneto.
Look at me in the eyes.
It's Magneto.
Right, yeah, you're so happy right now.
I would have got him on McClellan.
What did I say?
McClellan.
You said McClellan.
Was it McKellen?
Yes, McKellen.
Okay, well, I can say whatever I want. I'm Scottish.
Seems like everybody else does.
That is true. My point is, they actually look quite a bit like each other, which I think is what makes them playing Magneto kind of fun. But also, they have a very kind of similar intensity on screen. They're both Shakespearean actors. They both bring a real gravitas to everything they do. They both have made the X-Men franchises better for their appearances in them. And I would just love to see them continue to do that. Maybe, I don't know, maybe a Macbeth or a Hamlet or a... Well, Hamlet's not really conducive to the time jumps. Anything, really. I would like to see them, play the same character and the same nuances as they have already. But I think that could be fleshed out even more. This next one, I recognize that it's going to involve a little Hollywood fakery, and I'm okay with that. I would like to see Jessica Chastain, Cate Blanchett, and Meryl Streep all play the same character. Now, I recognize that Cate Blanchett is not that much older than Jessica Chastain. It's Hollywood, man. We can age people down. We can age them up. I just love all three of them dearly, and I think they would do something very interesting. My last pick, and I've already thought about the movie a little bit, I want to see John Boyega play a young cop. And I want to flash forward to see Idris Elba later in his career following up on the same case. I want that so hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't you?
Yes.
Don't you want that too?
I do.
I knew you would. So those are my picks. And obviously I do want to give a shout out because I think the casting of Joseph Gordon-Levitt to play young... Well, actually, Joseph Gordon-Levitt was already attached. I think having him, the Bruce Willis connection, I think is inspired, and I don't think anybody would have picked that out. I don't think anybody would have guessed that as an option, but I think it works really well. So I do want to give one final shout out to Looper, the inspiration for this week's game.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that selection, Mr. Dalton Stewart. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what are your picks?
Yeah, I want to kick it off. I've also thought about this movie that I want, and I want a urban legend-y, I mean that in the actual phrase, urban legend, not the movie.
A terrible film.
Version of Mr. Rogers' life, where they focus in on that urban legend of him being a sniper.
I'm into it.
With Clint Eastwood playing Mr. Rogers.
Oh, fuck yeah.
And Hugh Jackman playing young Mr.
Yeah.
Rogers running through the jungle, sniping people out.
Oh, my God. Yes, dude. Yeah. Yes.
Right?
You know, he has a son.
Yeah.
Scott Eastwood.
Yeah, Hugh Jackman's better.
Yeah. I mean, Hugh Jackman makes everything better. He's not a regular Ackman. He's a huge Ackman.
Oh, man.
There you go.
We're on fire today, folks.
I also want to see the movie because it should have happened a long time ago with Brad Pitt and Robert Redford playing the same character.
Oh my god, yeah.
Because
yeah.
Brad Pitt is Robert Redford.
Holy shit, dude.
They
yeah.
are one and the same, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure it's a real life Looper situation.
Dude, you're right.
Yeah.
You see the Big Short, where he literally
looks
is,
just like Robert Redford.
Yes, looks, talks, acts like Robert Redford.
They've had similar careers, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and you got the Clooney thing, and you got the Newman thing. I mean, yeah, it's a weird... Mm. Weird dynamic.
Man, I wish we should have had that Clooney Newman movie.
I also want to see Armie Hammer and Michael Caine playing two versions of the same character. I don't know what, some kind of British playboy, I'm sure. But, you know, Armie Hammer just has this kind of suave style about him, and I think he could capture that young Michael Caine status and coolness that Caine had when he was younger. And finally, I want Tom Hiddleston and John Hurt to play the same character something.
Oh my god, that's perfect.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, that's a good one, man.
Yeah.
Well done.
There you go. That's what I
like it very much. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Arthur Gordon. Mr. Caleb Masters, what are your selections?
Yeah, I've just got a couple. So I didn't go as far as to... I was trying really hard to figure out how to actually set these films, and that's the real trick. So I'm not as good as Arthur over there, who's actually got the whole plot of each one of these films laid out.
No, I've only got the first one because I've been wanting it for like 10 years.
Oh, okay. Well, that case.
I've wanted that to be a thing for so long.
That would be so good. So, Domhnall Gleeson, playing the younger. Older, Liam Neeson.
Or why not Brendan Gleeson?
Well,
I do like...
Father.
They are not the same man, okay?
I like that though. I do.
You know, you get two good Irish actors. Like, you know, they're both tall dudes. They're both
very tall.
Very tall. Both got the Irish thing going on. I dig that. So second pick, Emilia Clarke. That's my girl Daenerys from Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. Younger, older. I went back and forth on a couple different options, but I ended up settling on Emily Mortimer.
Yeah.
They've got the similar accent. They've got the same hairstyle, like when they're not, you know, in character.
And they both have a really similar intensity.
Very much so. Yeah. And they have a very similar screen presence too. I feel like
I love Emily Mortimer so
she's
much.
She's so good. Yeah, she's so underrated. Good. She's so great. She just doesn't get enough work, quite frankly.
She's got this show on HBO. Where she's playing a version of herself that I've seen a little bit of. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I haven't watched it yet, but I've heard about it. And lastly, I want younger Ewan McGregor, older Ewan McGregor. Because the man doesn't age.
He did recently play both Yeshua and the devil. So
yes, he did. I was like, I want Ewan McGregor in this game somehow. But the guys, I looked like 25 years ago. He looked exactly the same.
Have you guys heard the story about him coming in to record that dialogue for Force Awakens? He just like rides up on his motorcycle, smoking a cigarette while he's riding the motorcycle, flicks it away, comes in, does the dialogue, and says, "All right, JJ, have a good one, mate." And then like, peels off because he's the coolest guy ever.
God.
That's funny.
Give me that solo Obi-Wan movie, please.
He's got this. For a while recently, he had this like awesome like David Lynch fade. Where he had like almost his entire bottom part of his head shaved, and the top was just this amazing Lynchian like, he's beautiful. I'm in love with Ewan McGregor.
That's fair. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Caleb Masters. I only have two selections. One requires time travel in honor of Looper. The younger version is Cary Grant.
Yes.
Okay.
The older version is George Clooney.
Yes.
Fuck yeah, man. Yeah.
I'm into it.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously reversed and all that. But yeah, let's just switch it up because it's Looper. Why not? That's one selection. The other one, it does not require time travel. I'd like to see like a Frederick Douglass biopic. Young Frederick Douglass, David Oyelowo. Old Frederick Douglass, Billy D. Williams.
Billy D.
Yes, please.
Because they do look enough alike as two people. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the agedness and whatnot, I think it absolutely could be pulled off.
Do it. Book it.
It'd be fun.
Book it, Paul Dano.
I'm really scared to watch, speaking of David Oyelowo, I'm really scared to watch this, I think it's All the Way, is this new HBO film with Bryan Cranston and Anthony Mackie playing MLK. I don't want to compare Anthony Mackie and David Oyelowo's MLKs because I like them both so much. I'm going to pit them against each other in my head, and I don't want that. I don't want it.
MLK wouldn't want that.
He wouldn't.
Violence is not all right. You must stop. Well, there you go, dear listener. Those are our selections. We'd love to hear yours via those magical means that we all know as social media. So let us know about all of that. But I think now it's time to get down to business. It's business. It's business time. I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time. Ooh, it's business. It's business time. Everybody got their socks on?
All day, every day.
That's why they call them business socks. Moving right along, it's time to get down to some analysis. I'm so excited to hear what my dear co-hosts have to say. I go to you first, Mr. Caleb Masters. Let us have it.
This is the day I've been waiting for my entire life, Dustin.
I'm sorry.
Man, you've set really low expectations for yourself.
I know. It's you three. Oh, my God.
You realize you're recording a podcast.
Oh, my God.
I'm not even paid for this.
All right. Well, my 12-year-old self who loved time travel sci-fi original movies was waiting for this for a long time. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of time travel logic and why it doesn't matter and why Looper's telling you it definitely doesn't matter. So I'm going to go back a little bit and talk about how time travel kind of made its way as a plot device in pop culture. Kind of the progenitor of the whole shtick is H.G. Wells' 1895 novel, The Time Machine, which was – I mean, there were other time travel stories.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you've got Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court. But, yeah, H.G. Wells is the first one to be like, there is a machine. It's science.
Science. Yeah. Exactly. Now, the central premise of time travel stories usually involves changing history, either intentionally or by accident, with the story really being about the consequences of the past, how the changes of the past influence the future. The idea behind the story almost always remains the same. There are several various kind of subplot devices, different types of time travel stories that really differentiate them from each other. So we have Looper talking about time loops, which usually features a story or protagonist who relives the same day's events over and over and is desperate to escape from that time paradox. That it's an idea that you can see in films like Groundhog Day, Time Cop, or even most recently The Edge of Tomorrow, which is a really underrated film, by the way. There are stories where someone from the future sends a message back to the past, usually an attempt to either prepare for the future or, trying to change the past. You can see this in, like, 12 Monkeys, or even that really underrated TV show from the 90s starring Kyle Chandler, Early Edition, where the cat delivered the Tomorrow's Paper Today, if you guys remember that one. You've got films that are about the paradoxical nature of time travel. The most famous and most notable is called The Grandfather Paradox, which poses the idea that if you could go back in time and kill your grandfather to stop an event, you would never be able, you'd never be born in order to time travel back to kill your grandfather. Therefore, it's mute. You can't do it. Either that or you create some sort of alternate universe. There's a lot of different ideas on how that works. But it's a very popular kind of paradox. Now, often these paradoxes also cause the time loops that were previously mentioned. And a really wonderful example of this idea was presented in the original Star Trek series episode, The City on the Edge of Forever, where Dr. McCoy accidentally time travels back to the Great Depression era and saves someone's life. Someone who becomes a huge influencer and keeps the United States from getting into World War II, thus Nazi Germany wins the war, then there's no Starfleet, and then McCoy can't time travel back, and if it wasn't for Captain Kirk coming up with some sort of crazy, time travel explanation, he would have been doomed. The idea of the grandfather paradox is also the entire premise of films like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And also Terminator, the idea that, Kyle Reese is John Connor's dad, but John Connor sends Kyle Reese back, so chicken or the egg, where does it start first, right? Now, these are just a few different types of time travel stories, but the real question about time travel is it's not just a plot device. This is also, H.G. Wells put it, it's science. There is thought. There are people. There are physicists who study this. There are people who believe this is possible somehow, theoretically. Now, one of the most famed time travel physicists, Igor Novikov, asserted that if time travel exists, you cannot change what has already happened because it already happened and will always happen exactly the way the time travel enacted it. So there's no way to do what's not already been done. If you time travel back and did something, you've always done it that way, even before you time travel back. So basically, time is predestined. Everything's laid out. There's no way to change anything. Even if you do have access to time travel, you're just going to do what's already been done. Now, the principle only heightens that kind of the tragedy of the time loop element that we talked about earlier. That is also on display in Looper. Since proposing his idea in 1990, Novikov's self-consistency principle has been a major influencer in the likes of time travel and popular culture. As a fan of Lost, season 5 of Lost draws very, very heavily from the string theory of whatever happened, you can't go back and change things. But also Primer is also very, very dedicated to this idea, which is why you have, if you go look at like the charts for Primer, like the only way their time travel works is this crazy, massive chart. And it's you know, it's interesting. It's interesting in theory. Shane Carruth's Primer, I really respect as a film, but it's not fun. It's more of an intellectual exercise. And I think it's a cool movie. I'm glad it exists, and I really am. But I don't think, especially to the mainstream, it's not really great storytelling as much as trying to explain how time travel theoretically would work if we actually followed it through to its logical science. But which brings me to my point, what are considered the best time travel stories? What have been the most successful? Now, while I think scientists are going to really dig the stuff you see in 2004's Primer, mainstream knows Back to the Future, Terminator, Planet of the Apes. These are all films that are really clever with how they use time travel, but all of them, the time travel breaks down inevitably every single time. Now, how does this tie into Looper? As we kind of talked about in our review section, this film is playing with the tropes of time travel. It is talking about, you know, how time travel works. Ryan Johnson gives you just enough. It talks about the idea of time loops, and it even flirts with the idea of time paradoxes. So there's just enough science to tease you to think that there's more there. But ultimately, the film goes out of its way to tell you that the science and mechanics of how time travel works is pointless. It's not the point, and it's not nearly as interesting as the stories you can tell about time travel. He pretty much sums it up in one line when Bruce Willis, they sit down and Joseph Gordon-Levitt says, hey, so tell me how this works, you know, and he says, you know what, I don't want to talk about this time travel because if we start talking about it, then we're going to be here all day just making diagrams and straws.
It's one of my favorite things in the movie, Ryan Johnson saying, shut the fuck up, nerds, no one cares.
No one cares.
Like, yes, I'm glad Neil deGrasse Tyson is a person, I'm glad that he's in the world, and I'm glad he's like saying, hey, you know, but nobody gives a shit if you can grow potatoes on Mars. It's not important. Yes, it's cool that you can. No one cares.
Yeah, and that's the thing with time travel. It's like, yes, theoretically, there's some interesting ideas that are probably a lot more viable realistically, if that was to work, than what works in film. But that's not a fun film. Primer's not a fun film. It's not something you sit down and say, yes, let's watch Primer, because that's going to tell us about how time travel could be cool. You know, at least for, I would say, the mainstream. So the film kind of concludes that science should always be secondary to the story. A great time travel story trumps sound time travel story. And if you're not on board with that, you need to stop watching time travel fiction, because otherwise your head will explode.
You're just not going to be able to enjoy yourself.
Yeah, no. No one likes that.
Excellent. I appreciate that very, very much, Mr. Caleb Masters. Mr. Dalton Stewart, what analysis do you bring?
Well, I want to talk about something that we've talked about at length on this show, but it's not come up in quite some time, and Dustin is actually typically the one to bring this up, but I felt it was my time. I want to talk about redemptive violence and the myth thereof. Redemptive violence is exactly what it sounds. You redeem yourself through acts of violence, and it's a pretty classic story trope. I mean, it's in Westerns like The Magnificent Seven, The Isle of Josie Wales. It's in war movies like The Dirty Dozen, specifically that because it's about, you know, prisoners redeeming themselves through murdering Nazis. I mean, and, you know, even some of the samurai films of Akira Kurosawa that inspired a lot of the Westerns of the 60s and 70s, Seven Samurai, Yojimbo, things like that. It is a long and time-honored, I mean, it goes back to Greek mythology. You have sullied your name amongst your culture or your gods, and you must redeem yourself through brutal murders. It is a long and time-honored tradition in the telling of stories. But it's bullshit, man. And as much as I love, you know, diving through a hail of bullets in slow motion to go save Morpheus, and I love it a lot, violence only begets more. I'm not a religious man, but there's some truth in that. You can't just go around shooting people. You just can't. Bad things happen. You can't just run around killing people. And I think what Looper does so well is it makes Bruce Willis the figure for redemptive violence. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, after, you know, he retires from looping, doesn't really kill anybody. He gets involved in some violent confrontations, but he is not the focus of the murder in this film. It's Bruce Willis, and Bruce Willis kills the fuck out of people, which makes him perfect casting in this film, because we're used to seeing Bruce Willis commit wholesale slaughter. What the film very smartly does is show us Bruce Willis doing something we've never seen him do, which is murdering a child. Which is the myth of redemptive violence taken to the extreme. He gets presented with the kill baby Hitler scenario, where he knows that in the future, this person is going to rise up and just rain holy terror on people. He is basically going to all but take over the world through taking over crime syndicates, which is going to result in the death of his wife. Again, you can't just go around shooting people. People who have nothing to do with it will get shot through an open window. See this film and also this weekend's The Nice Guys. You just can't do it. And what Bruce Willis shows us is that when you're focused for making your life better, redeeming yourself in your own eyes, when that focus is at the end of a gun, you're going to end up murdering a child and no one's going to like you anymore. You just can't do it. Meanwhile, what Joseph Gordon-Levitt realizes is, and Dustin talked about this already, kind of how he feels like this particular sequence is a little wonky. I think it's beautiful. Joseph Gordon-Levitt saying, and there, you know, I saw the future for Sid laid out in front of me. Like, I knew it was going to happen. You know, he starts to run across this field to try and stop Bruce Willis, and he realizes he can't. He's not going to make it. He's not going to get there. He doesn't. This gun doesn't have the range, and if he fails, this kid's going to lose his mom. So he kills himself. He kills himself to erase older Joe from history, and that is redemptive violence is usually only successful when it's against yourself. I'm not advocating self harm in any way, but I mean, for it to really have emotional weight, for it to ring true emotionally, it's about self sacrifice. It's not about forcing people to sacrifice their bodies before you through a hail of bullets. It's about admitting that some things are colossally broken, and sometimes it's your fault, and sometimes you have to remove yourself from the equation. And again, not saying violently, sometimes you just have to step away from a situation and admit that you can't make it better, and your presence is just going to make things worse. So you're just going to have to resign yourself to it. And I think that's something that's really beautiful about this film is Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you know, young Joe versus old Joe's approach to the situation. Young Joe, you know, meets this woman and this child and tries to have a relationship with him. And even then realizes there is no happy, sunshiny ending for me. I killed a lot of people and I don't get to just decide, walk away from it and have a good life. And that's what Bruce Willis's old Joe couldn't accept, is that you don't get to have the life you've had and walk away all happy, sunshine and daisies. It's going to come back to haunt you. And so young Joe removes himself from the equation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really, really like that reading a lot, Dalton. And the thing about the myth of redemptive violence and the way you sort of trump it is, it, to an extent, what Levitt does in killing himself. And what it more fundamentally means, because it's played out in different ways in different films, is absorbing violence in oneself rather mm-hmm. than continuing to extend violence. It is an absolute break with the cycle of violence. It's finally somebody saying, I will lay down arms and mm-hmm. I won't do this anymore. And that's the only way you find a way
despite
out.
My urge and my capacity for violence, I'm going to stop.
Right, right. Well, killing X is not going to make it better. Like, what if someone had told Hitler he really should have been a painter? Like, what if he had that one person who just pushed him that direction?
Well, and I think that's the beauty of this story is the end result is not we got to kill the Rainmaker before he comes the Rainmaker. It's, you know, we could just make sure the Rainmaker has a good life.
Exactly.
And is surrounded by people that love him, and maybe he does become a superhero, which is kind of cool. That is something I really love about this film is, you know, we are priming either – Sid is either about to have a superhero origin story or a supervillain origin story, and Joe's path or Joe's choices are going to define that role in the story. And there's where you get into some time travel paradoxes with, I mean, was the Rainmaker always going to be there? Not important. It doesn't matter. What matters is the emotional weight of the end of this film, which I think really rings true.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Dalton Stewart. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what analysis do you bring, sir?
Abe states, well, you don't know, but the movies that you're copying are copying other movies. A 20th century affect. In our first face-to-face interaction between Abe and Joe, this is one of the points that they talk about. And what Looper sets out to do is imitate the movies that came before it, I think, to an end. Looper is all about cycles and loops. Much of what Joe's style and character does is imitate an earlier time period. And in large, that's how culture on the whole works. The style of today is very reminiscent of the 80s. Looper is also very planted in the 80s, a decade in which two of the biggest narrative and visual influences that the film is replicating were released. Of course, I'm talking of Ridley Scott's Blade Runner and James Cameron's The Terminator, and to a lesser extent Terminator 2. These two movies, along with 12 Monkeys, are vital to the foundation of Looper. The narrative and thematic presence is a variation on the story from The Terminator and the themes taken further in Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Much of the visual style of the film, though, calls back to Blade Runner. The way the city is designed, the slightly updated, not out of the realm of possibility vision of the future, the darkness, the dirty underbelly, these are all elements lifted from Scott's masterpiece. Of course, the intertextual connections don't end there, and this is why it's important to know film, to have seen film, and to see as many movies as you can, because you never know when some indie filmmaker, some auteur, some director will cast somebody, use some bit of music, have some production design to harken back to another film. Bruce Willis himself is a huge intertextual reference because of a movie we talked about a few weeks back, 12 Monkeys, wherein Bruce Willis is sent back in time to try and understand something bad that would be on the horizon. His motivation is different between the two, but if you've seen 12 Monkeys, I think that adds something to the performance here and his inclusion. And as Willis is wandering around seeking out his target in Looper, a heavy bass-driven driving score is taking over, which almost perfectly harkens back once again to Terminator and the score that accompanies the T-800. All of this goes back to Abe's line, this 20th century effect, this idea of being caught up in nostalgia. That line in the film is a lot smarter than its delivery would have you believe. It's a very thrown away line as they banter back and forth when we first meet Abe. I think not only is the film commenting on a cycle of violence, which Dalton has spoke greatly to, and Dustin, which appears to be his modus operandi by the time the credits roll, however, I feel like it has much to say about the way we get engrossed in nostalgia and try to take what's old to make it new again, even though much of that which we stole from was a copy of earlier generations. Fashion, culture, society, it's all on a loop. Thanks to Mad Men, there was a resurgence in that 60s style. Much of the fashion of the hipster population is really a callback to the early 90s, where you look at those pictures and we wonder why we were wearing that, and then you go outside and you wonder why those people are wearing that. There's
I have a haircut from the 20s, so yeah.
There's something about the sleek elegance of the 60s and Mad Men that calls back to the suave, stylish prohibition of the 20s and that kind of swinging era. It's hard to be wholly original anymore, and I think that's what Johnson's point is at times. There are only so many stories that can be dressed up in only so many ways, and it's finding new, pretty fascinating ways for us to tell these stories while faithfully paying homage to those films that came before and using that foundation to add new meaning to the film.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Arthur Gordon. My analysis is going to begin with this statement. The movies you're copying are just copies of other movies. It's just a 20th century affectation. Because I want to talk about some similar things. You mentioned Blade Runner. I want to talk about the references to film noir and classic film and how this movie actually plays out the film noir cycle itself as a film. Now, it's full of references, and again, in every way, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is a Sam Spade, Philip Marlowe, Humphrey Bogart kind of character. Yeah, in every way, you know, we've got the voiceover narration, we've got you know, the dirty city streets, we've got the criminal underworld, and all of that sort of stuff going forward. We have other references also. You know, the name of the strip club is the Belle Aurora, which is the name of Rick's cafe that he owned in Paris, where he met Ilsa in Casablanca. And so, which is what we call a near-noir film. There is something of a mystery, but it's of a slightly different stripe. And I want to make reference to Edward Dimmenberg's book, Film Noir and the Spaces of Modernity. And he talks a lot about just the city architecture and the architectural space of the film noir cycle, which runs roughly from 1940 to 1958. And within that, you first of all see, till about 1949, this centripetal force towards the city in those films, in which you are diving deep into the dark underbelly of the city. It is full of those wet streets at night and alleyways and steam coming out of the floor grates in the street and those sorts of images. And it is, the world is seedy and wrong and broken. And it is sort of this discussion of this huge community of people who formerly lived in the countryside and then have then been forced to, because of economic pressures and just the search for opportunity, to move themselves into the cities, and only then to be found in lives of crime and of squalor and general oppression. And so from 1941 till about 1949, you see this centripetal, this inward sort of force that's driving these films inward. But then about 1949, 1950-ish, there begins to be this shift where it is centrifugal, and the film noirs begin to spread their ways back out to the countryside. The best example of this is The Asphalt Jungle, starring Sterling Hayden, directed by, I want to say John Huston, but don't quote me on that. And in that film, we have a character who's from Kentucky, who is in the middle of the city, a part of gambling rings and those sort of things, a sort of a small-time crook, and he's just trying to make his way back out to the country. And the point of generally these films, and you could think about Out of the Past, and you could think about Touch of Evil, and other films also that are removed. They're definitely part of the film noir cycle, but they're definitely removed from the city as their locus of operations, even though they may begin outwards or they find themselves being flung outwards by that centrifugal force yet again. Looper does exactly that. We begin in the city. It is two movies to a great extent. There is a city film in which we see this criminal working in the criminal underworld, just trying to find some way to get ahead. He could have been a private detective. He could have been, you know, a small time hitman. It could have been anything, and it would have fit very, very well into a film noir. And then you have this other story of a man on the run, and that man on the run is almost always finding himself out in the country for various and sundry reasons. And that the influence of evil and of wickedness and of sort of the overall corruption of society has even reached the most idealized versions of Americana, right? And that this place has been unsullied. This place is purity. That when we're watching those original film noirs, we see, oh yeah, the city, yes, absolutely, the city is bad and it's been corrupted by big money and big power and all of that sort of stuff. And of course, as the cycle plays itself out in the original film noir cycle, the realization is, no, the problem is much deeper. There is much more wrong going on with the world, and it even infects and affects those parts of the world which we thought to ourselves to be, you know, above reproach, that were unassailable in some way. And so it moves all of that discussion out there, and it does something of a restoration in which Sid and Emily Blunt's character do get away, but clearly they can be touched by the evil even there in their cornfields, right? In Kansas. I mean, you don't get much more American than that, right, Superman? And so that's all happening there. And the film does very well is play out the entirety of the film noir cycle and say that there is a fundamental corruption that's out there, and it must be fought in all the places. We cannot just assume, hey, you know, they got problems out there in the cities, but where we are, it's okay. They got problems in this country, but where we are, it's fine. They've got problems amongst this people group, but for our folks, it's going to be fine. That there really is corruption everywhere, and it must be found and exterminated. And it must be, you know, justice must be brought to bear in every possible circumstance and situation. And I just find that to be really, really interesting. And again, we see both of those forces, the centripetal inward force and that centrifugal outward force at work in the film, much in line with film noir, as Arthur was talking about the sort of nostalgia touch. So a little more detail on that, I guess, is what I'm offering at this point. So there you go, dear listener. That's our analysis. I'm so glad you listened to all that we had to say. Let's just take a moment and hear a word from our sponsors.
Here comes the money.
Here we go. Money talk.
Here comes the money. Money, 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 money.
This week, we want to thank Carrie Rayburn and Mindy Laff for being our newest contributors on Patreon. The continued support of our listeners is both humbling and inspiring. So again, thank you. It is through the support of listeners like Carrie and Mindy
that we are able to produce the quality and quantity of content that we do.
Because of the pledges of our wonderful patrons, we've been able to get business cards, upgrade equipment, purchase a camera for live streaming, and that is just the tip of the iceberg for 2016. We have so many surprises in store for you, dear listener. So again, to those who have pledged, thank you. Thank you so much. And if you're not sure about pledging, but want more information, then go to patreon.com/GTM. That's patreon.com/GTM. Or go to goodtrashmedia.com and click Become a Patron. Again, thank you so much. And back to the show.
I think she smell my cologne. It's called brand new money. Making major moves, man, ain't a damn thing funny. Pippin hood rats, the playboy bunnies. They see the...
Thank you again for all of your support, listeners. We move on, though, to the point of the show. We must render a verdict. We must put this film on the shelf or in the trash, and then recommend our else's or our insteads. I go to you first, Mr. Caleb Masters. What select you?
Yeah, I mean, this movie is on my shelf, and I, after watching it, I don't regret putting it on my shelf. To recommend to go along with it, I'm going to throw another really underrated low-key sci-fi film that I really like that, like, literally nobody heard about, which is Predestination starring Ethan Hawke. You want to talk about loopers and time loops. Mother of God, be prepared for a giant mindfuckery of time loops, but man, it's a great movie. Really, really cool, cerebral kind of sci-fi thing going on there. I also want to recommend Duncan Jones' Source Code, which is a movie dealing with kind of the Groundhog Day-style time loop, a main character trying to escape from that one event happening over and over again. And then lastly, another really underrated kind of time travel pick, Safety Not Guaranteed, by Colin Trevorrow, who went on to direct Jurassic World and is now directing Star Wars Episode IX.
It's a really nice little movie.
It is. It's really underappreciated. Yeah. I really like it a lot. It's sweet, too. It's not like a, you know, the movie's, it's a romance more than anything.
But, it's a sweet little film.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, we already took all my picks from the time travel in our 12 Monkeys episode, so obviously also go watch 12 Monkeys and listen to our episode on that as well.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Caleb Masters. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what do you say? Shelf or trash? Else or instead? I see you pensively making the decision right now.
I am. I'm torn. I don't know. I was gonna say trash. I think that I'm going to say, I'll say shelf. It's a hypothetical thing anyway. Instead, or
you do also actually own it.
Yeah. Well, because I needed to watch it. Else, take a look at the other movies I mentioned, Blade Runner, Terminator, especially Terminator 2, Judgment Day, which is just great. For more Paul Dano being awesome, I say watch Love and Mercy because it's a great movie. Those are my picks, Dustin.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Arthur Gordon. Mr. Dalton Stewart, what are your selections? Oh, wait, shelf or trash? Then what are your selections, Else or Instead?
Yeah, I'm going to shelf it, too. I think Rian Johnson is a really fabulous filmmaker and is about to be one of the biggest names in filmmaking on planet Earth come December 2017. So, yeah, fuck it. Let's put it on the shelf. I think you should watch with it some of his other work. He directed three of the best episodes of Breaking Bad, yeah. Fly 51 and Ozymandias, which are just...
Stellar. Yeah, I was wrecked for days after Ozymandias.
Yeah, they're three of the best episodes of television in the last 10 years, and he made all of them, and they're just amazing. He also directed an episode of a very short-lived but much underappreciated FX series called Terriers, which stars my boy Donald Logue as a just down-and-out PI, so you can tell why it's right up Rian Johnson's alley. I highly recommend that. I also recommend Brick, which we've discussed on this show, which I think still might be his best film. I think it's an absolute, I think it's a masterpiece. I really do. I think it's a great piece of American cinema. Yeah. You got to get, if you're not already on the Rian Johnson train, you got to get on it so you can feel like the fucking cool one in line at Force Awakens harder 2 years from now or a year and a half from now. You got to be the one that was on the bandwagon. You need to know what's up because he's a better filmmaker than JJ. JJ's a really great brand builder. Ryan's a better auteur, so you want to be on that bandwagon. I would also recommend a time travel story about mothers and sons, about coming to a better understanding of each other, and that's Terminator 2 Judgment Day. It's not... also, yes, I like Back to the Future, but Terminator 2 Judgment Day, which was Caleb's very first host pick on this show, and is one of my very favorite films of all time, and is totes bitchin', and also deals a little bit with the myth of redemptive violence.
Excellent, excellent. I do want to point out the name for the sequel of the Star Wars film is The Empire Strikes Harder. is what it's actually going to be.
Oh, we shall see. We shall see.
Man, okay. Anyway, moving
on. Oh, shit. No, there was one I forgot. I'm so sorry. I wanted to give a shout out to an underseen Bruce Willis film. This weekend is the release of The Nice Guys, which unfortunately isn't doing tracking as well as it should be because it's a great film. But I wanted to give a shout out to a Shane Black written film that's way less known than some of his other films, and that's The Last Boy Scout with Bruce Willis.
I love that movie.
Yeah, it's great, right? It is a great buddy cop neo-noir.
Damon Wayans
and fucking Bruce Willis are a great buddy cop pairing, and it's a fabulous movie.
We have $600 pants. It better come with a color TV.
Oh, my God. Let's go watch it right now.
I know, right? It's so good. Okay, excellent. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Dalton Stewart. I am going to say... I want to shout out to Brick also. I mean, absolutely. I think Brick is the film you accompany this with. If you want to check out that film noir cycle of the centripetal to centrifugal force, you would start out with the Maltese Falcon, you would move on to the Asphalt Jungle, and then you would conclude with Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, and I think you'd see a bit of what I'm trying to talk about there with that. In terms of time travel, I am really addicted to Jatem Jatem right now, which is an Alain René film from the French New Wave in the 60s.
You wrote about that on iProtein, didn't you, Dustin?
I did, actually. It came up. So you can check out my article there. And it's about French science fiction in general. And it is the time travel entry that I used for that particular bit of writing. So take a look at that and all of those things, because that's what makes it so worthwhile and so much fun. So do that. But before we move on and conclude our show, we want to talk about how we can have this conversation with you all via those magical means that we all know as social media. Mr. Arthur Gordon, do you know anything about that stuff?
I like to remind everybody, if you don't already know, you can go to facebook.com/goodtrashmedia, click that like button. We post everything over there, so you can quickly find what we're doing and keep up with us. We also like to post random news and articles when it comes up and then we think you would find interesting, so go keep up with us over there. You could also find us, you could also go straight to the source, goodtrashmedia.com. You could leave a comment on the page there at the website and, you know, tell us, what did you think of Looper? Did you like it? Did you hate it? Were we all right? Was Dustin the brightest guy in the room? We don't know. We really don't. You have to tell
us
these things.
We know that's not true.
Yeah, I was just about to say the same thing.
You could also email us, goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. I understand some of our listeners don't do the social media thing, and so that is another way that they can keep up with us if they would like to comment on anything that we do.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Arthur Gordon. Mr. Dalton Stewart, what do you know?
Well, Dustin, I know a couple of things. I know that my love for you is strong and transcends time and space. I know that I like cats a lot. I'm also quite fond of Brie. Oh, you mean what do I know about social media?
Yeah.
I know that you can find the Good Trash Media Network on Twitter @good_trash. We tweet about Back to the Movies. We tweet about my show, The People's History of Film, and we tweet about the show entering your ear holes right this second, the Good Trash Honor Cast. So if you are wanting to engage with us in 140 characters or less, you can find us on Twitter @good_trash.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Mr. Dalton Stewart. We're going to now move on. It's back to the AB1700 randomizer, and we're going to select a yet another bingo ball with a name upon it. Giles the Dog has the honor this week of rolling it. Thank you very much, Giles. Go ahead and give that a roll for us.
Come on, Giles. You're always my favorite. Come on, buddy.
I fucking hate this dog.
All right, and the film is I Wait with Bated Breath.
You need to be quicker on the draw, old man.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm here. It's The Lost Boys, guys.
Fuck yes.
I'm so excited.
Oh, God, yes.
Kiefer Sutherland for days.
I really thought you were about to say The Last Boy Scout. I was going to shit my pants. Oh, my God.
You know what?
I'll take Lost Boys, though.
Next time, I'm just going to lie. And
yeah, and just say whatever movie you want to watch.
Whatever I want to watch. Yeah. I get a host pick every time it's the AB1700. So there you go, dear listener. Take a look at Lost Boys. Take a look at Looper.
Sexy fucking Kiefer Sutherland. Mm-hmm. Mm.
Just take a look at any movie and then have a conversation, because that's what makes watching the movie so worthwhile. It's so much more than just 90 minutes in a bucket of popcorn, or in this case, 120. It is about the conversation. So have that conversation, and we'll see you all next time.
The Good Trash Genre Cast is produced and edited by Arthur Gordon. Direction by Dustin Sells. Social media by Alexandra Bohannon, Caleb Masters, and Dalton Stewart. Our intro and outro is Night Call by Kavinsky and Lovebox. We are also proud to feature music from Deer Tick this week on the program. For more information on this episode of the Good Trash Genre Cast, as well as the rest of the Good Trash Media family, please visit goodtrashmedia.com.